Psalm of David.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Bardcast B-side on Radio Maria with me, Tim Hutchinson, facilitating, and with
Sarah de Nordwall, a bard with the Bard School, and now Bardcast, happily enough. Thank you, Tim, and Radio Maria.
And the idea of the B-side, as we've said before, is that we look at the episode that has come before in the Bardcast. And the Bardcast is a program that you've put on, Sarah, that looks at poetry, both old and new, and brings it to the cutting edge of the culture, which is
grace.
Indeed.
Yes, indeed.
And the last episode, episode 15, I named beauty the enemy of chaos because it didn't have a name.
Oh, yes. And I discovered we had given it a name and we'd forgotten. And it was looking for the things that never die.
Looking for the things that never die.
Yeah. So both of those names are actually really compatible, aren't they?
I had, while I was going through it, there was a number of other things that came to mind. I mean, it's not too late. We could always rename it if we wanted to. But this kind of could almost act as a bit of a summary, although I'll do that as well. So we called it the Beauty, the Enemy of Chaos, but it could also have been called, perhaps, The Warrior Wields the Quill,
mm-hmm.
Nagasaki Prays,
mm-hmm.
or The Warrior Writes Calligraphy.
Yes,
quite
indeed.
Like that one. And I think you can kind of guess what some of the themes were in that if you didn't hear the Bardcast the Bardcast episode 15, but do listen to it on the podcast if you haven't.
Because we had all the beautiful poem from a listener, Valerie Maria Anthony, and it was just absolutely gorgeous. And her spiritual practice as a poet is all about looking for signs of love in the world as opposed to signs of being oppressed, which is something that she told me about her spiritual practice. And you can hear her thoughts about that on the Bardcast. It's just wonderful to see different listeners' poems evolve, you know, as they send them in. And I know already that we have a wonderful poem from a listener ready for the Bardcast that I'll be rewriting next week. But maybe we can talk about that writing prompt later, Tim.
Yes, I wanted to focus in on Valerie's poem as well. So just to give a bit of an overview of what happened in the Bardcast and a reminder to listeners if they don't know, this is really a place for people to be inspired to write and have an opportunity to send their poems in to Sarah de Nordwall and to have them read and reflected on the radio and to nourish artists of many different kinds on Radio Maria.
And the important thing being that those artists are essentially contemplative, because the culture in which I was raised, you know, I say raised, but like at university, most of the things that we studied were by people who either believed that, you know, God didn't exist or that Marxism was the way forwards and so on and so forth. There was no room, hardly at all, to consider contemplatives who had written, people who pray and are reaching from the deep wellsprings of their heart to express what Christ is revealing to them. And whether they write about faith directly or not, there's a completely different feel, there's a completely different sense of hope within the poetry of those who are walking the pilgrim path. So that really is my passion in having a bard school, to create a space where people who speak about faith or from a place of faith feel safe to do so.
So in the Bardcast episode 15, Beauty, the Enemy of Chaos, started with a piece by a Franciscan friar that you recently met at a conference in Oxford.
Yes.
And
that conference was covered by Radio Maria, actually. So are there any podcasts or YouTube clips from that people could go back to?
Not yet, no.
Oh, right.
awkwardly, he says. But there will be soon. Yes, that Convergence conference was really wonderful. And he said something about awe that you mentioned, which I thought was quite beautiful, that I don't remember it exactly now, but I have it down as always the correct response to the glory that is present in reality. Does
yes.
that capture it more?
Yes,
or less?
He says that there's a a wonderful context, a spiritual context to our lives that, you know, that has a radiance that has no name. I mean, do go back to listen to his actual quote, because some theologians and some commentators write as poets themselves, and only the words they use sort of will do.
Yes.
In fact, it reminds me of Pope St. John Paul II, who said that there are some kinds of theological insight that only a poet or a creative can express, because it's not just about abstract concepts, it's about the whole felt and lived experience of that revelation. And he definitely captures that lovely Franciscan friar, and he writes a lot about Tolkien because Tolkien does this too, the numinous in the everyday and the sublime, the lyric of the domestic. So, and I, in fact, that is what Valerie's poem in fact captures, the love between the father and the son
yes.
that she notices at Mass.
I was going to mention that, yes. So and what was lovely about Valerie's poem was seeing the process that she describes in writing, and how she went from being encouraged to look for moments where one feels oppressed to abandoning that altogether and going to look for examples of love and seeing them as parallels of God's love for us. And so she writes this beautiful poem about seeing a father and a son in Mass and the interaction between the two of them, which is really lovely. You must listen to it if you haven't already.
And that's because she became a Catholic and moved from an ideological setting into the faith. And that's how her poetry is such an interesting before and after mm-hmm. experience that you mention. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's embodied, which I think is really important as well. And then she talks about how it changes the way that I think it's something that you drew from her description, is that because she is engaged in this process of writing, she begins to see things differently and draw out those meanings. And that's also one of the things that I think we're trying to do in developing the art side of what we do on Radio Maria, is to show how it's essential in the contemplative gaze of the world. Then there's the whole very intense and very profound reflection on Takashi Nagai and his story, and the chaos and the destruction that came in Japan with the atomic bombs, but the saint that emerges from that story. So if you haven't heard of Takashi Nagai, he was a survivor of the atomic bomb, and devoted his life to a pursuit of hope. And I think another title for this last episode could have been 1,000 cherry trees.
Mm.
It was 1,000 cherry trees, wasn't
it? Yes, it was. He planted 1,000 cherry trees. Yes, he was in Nagasaki, and there was that very interesting phrase that has grown up since the two atomic bombs were dropped, that Hiroshima rages, Nagasaki prays.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's unfair to anybody surviving the horrors of Hiroshima. But it was extraordinary how he lived out hope, and how he went and brought his children up in a hut in the middle, consciously in the middle of the nuclear wasteland, because he again became a Catholic, and through his lovely wife, who was killed in the bomb. And yet his poems became the seed of hope that allowed Nagasaki to be a place where people saw their sacrifice and their suffering as not fruitless.
Yeah.
They saw it, in fact, as a contribution to the end of the war. I mean, and if that isn't a radical acceptance of your own suffering, I don't know what is. And it's his happiness that flows through. And of course, the cherry blossom represents hope and love and beauty, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes, and then after that, there was this beautiful reflection on memory, which I think sort of pivots on a poem that you share, where you see the artist as one who stands on a shoreline, which I thought was a really beautiful image, and looking at memories. And I want us to go a little bit deeper into this whole idea of memory. That's actually what I would really like to focus
Lovely.
On that
oh, great.
Today. And then, of course, there's the beautiful not necessarily memorized, just known poem yes. of your godson.
Yes.
Which is, well, not as, it's a poem, yes, that is true, but more properly, it's a prayer. Of yes. the August Queen?
August Queen,
August
yes.
Queen.
Yeah, it's a prayer for Our Lady to send down angels
send down
to help
angels.
Us.
I love
and
that.
And obviously it just appealed to him because he just sort of absorbed it and he's reciting it at the end.
Mm.
It's just so gorgeous. In fact, I'll really remember it, Tim. One of my prompts, well, there were two from last week, was to go away and learn something off by heart, whether it's a prayer,
yes.
a piece of scripture, or one of your own poems even.
Yeah, yeah, and that is something that I really encourage everyone to do, and I'm going to do it as well.
Well done. Have you chosen what you're going to do, Tim?
I have not, but I have been. I think I might do sort of a Jared Manley Hopkins poem.
Oh, that's a great idea.
But we shall see. But
I must say that a friend of mine, Maggie, her daughter, when she was about five, read you know, all this Juice and Joy, you know, that Jared Manley Hopkins, mm. and she herself at five or six learnt it all off by heart. I mean, children are just remarkable.
Yeah.
And when you give them beautiful things to their beautiful, sweet selves, you know, the synergy is a moment of numinous joy.
Yes. So I was listening to a podcast this week by the children's writer, Catherine Rundell, who said that when she was growing up, her parents had this very strong belief that children should memorize things, even if they don't understand them.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And that
definitely.
They would... they would do set them in good stead in their future as they came to understand them. And I didn't do a great deal of memorization when I was a child, but I do remember that there were certain films I knew kind of backwards, even before I understood what the words
there you go.
Said. Fortunately, some of them were decent enough to actually
well,
set
thank
me in
God
good,
for that,
good
Tim.
Stead.
You know, actually, it's interesting because, of course, what they do know through neuroscience that when people are listening to nonsense, like a mishmash of sounds that aren't language, different bits of their brain light up to when they're listening to a language that they don't even speak and have never heard before. The brain recognizes it as language. Isn't that fascinating? So, bouncing off your point about remembering things off by heart, the child will be learning language and its structure and its beauty, as well as some of its concepts, at a deep level and yeah. learning to structure things. And I used to say I never studied anything about poetry, and that's why I feel free to write it. But of course, that's nonsense, really, because my mother read poetry to me and I've been absorbed in language. And I do think it's wonderful to hear children reciting poems because they love them with a deep love.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. What children do, they either hate or love. That's important too.
Yeah. And so I wanted to speak about beauty, but I think for the sake of time, let's go straight into memory. And
oh, yes. I
want
to hear what you thought about that.
About what? Beauty or memory?
The memory thing you were
sure.
saying that landed with you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, memory is there are a number of thoughts. So let me try and kind of... bring them together. One of them was the fact that I'd once heard visual art, or let's say like sketching, painting, all that kind of artwork described as a memory.
Ooh.
In the sense that the artist always has to have what he or she is bringing forth implanted in memory first. So even if you are painting or sketching a still life, and you're going straight from the image onto the canvas or the page, it has to have, for even if it's the briefest moment, imprint itself and be held in the memory
yes,
and
yes,
then
yes.
placed onto the page.
Hmm.
And what fascinates me about thinking about memory in this context is, why is it that we love memory if we think of art as memory? Why do we love it? And why do we sometimes love it even more than we love the thing itself? So, I mean, an apple in a fruit bowl,
yeah.
you know, like it's not really that interesting, let's be honest, but...
I'll talk to Charlotte about that, who's a still life painter anyway, moving swiftly on. Yes,
no, but,
carry on.
But when somebody makes a drawing of it or a painting of it, it suddenly we think, oh, that's lovely. I'd love to actually sit and look at that and consider it. But you wouldn't necessarily come into somebody's house and sit there and look at the fruit bowl. but you might look at a picture of the fruit bowl. So yeah, why? Yeah, why is it that it's more beautiful? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, interestingly enough, Charlotte and I discuss this quite a lot because she is a still life painter. And she just loves what she does. And I'd love to get her to send us some thoughts in to the show. Mm. I think one of the things is that the work of an artist is the work of interpretation and revelation. Mm-hmm. And so passing through the human person is an experience of what God has given us, which is this unique experience of human beings to be creative, to interpret and return to the creator, the beauty of things both seen and unseen. Mm. And as Father, was it Giuliano, his name, said, that, you know, the context of our looking is the numinous, the spiritual, the giftedness of the world. And so when you see a bowl of fruit and think, oh, I'll have an apple. No, apples are boring. I'll have a banana. No, actually, I'll go to the fridge and get a bar of chocolate. We're just, you know, in our senses, we're just a little bit, what's the word? Not very refined. But when a painter says, no, look, I've spent 9 hours looking at this. Come and have a look. Mm. You go, oh, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It's the gift of the contemplative gaze.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. And maybe more of this will come out in a few questions that I jotted down here. So the first one is, why do you think memory has gone out of fashion?
Well, perhaps, gosh, there's a lot of suppositions in that, aren't there? I think because we can have instant now experiences a lot, and because we're so busy, we don't have to return to our memories to draw forth nourishment.
Yeah. And what do you think are some of the misconceptions about memory? And I mean, you know, just the practical art of memorizing things.
Oh, you're talking about learning things off by heart. Well,
yeah.
That because it takes time, and because we have the printed word and we have the digital word and we don't have an oral culture anymore. However, I would say that it's coming back into fashion because it reveals our own interiority and it gives us an inner gift.
Mm-hmm. But what do you think people misunderstand about the art of memorizing that causes them not to do it?
Well, perhaps it was their experience of just being not given space to discuss what they'd memorized later, perhaps.
Because mm-hmm. That's fruitful, yeah. Isn't it? That's fruitful. It brings forth something when you reflect on what you've memorized.
Yes, absolutely. It becomes your own when you've memorized it. I remember when my teacher at school gave me the part of, you know, what was his name? Thomas Becket, Saint Thomas Becket. And she said, this prose will be with you for the rest of your life and will come forth when you need it. And it absolutely does. I often think about those lines, you know, mankind cannot stand very much reality, or to do the right deed for the wrong reason, that is the greatest treason, you know. And I have friends who spend a lot of time in a very organized way memorizing scripture. And this is something glorious because truth is alive, as the Russians say in that proverb, one word of truth is worth the whole world.
Mm.
And what is a word? You know, it's a spiritual living thing.
Yeah.
So memory, of course, is a power of the soul. Will, intellect, and memory. We forgot those one broadcast, didn't we, when we were trying to remember them, ironically. And like memory is this wonderful shared wellspring where things are not just static, but alive. That's what I think is important.
I went to a concert recently. It was one of the colleges in Cambridge that was putting it on. And two of the singers who were soloists in the concert had their lyrics on tablets or iPads or something in front of them. And I must say, I found it incredibly annoying
that they
would have to look down and you could see them swiping with their fingers or sort of like moving the page up and down to find their place.
Yeah.
And the songs were really not that complicated. And I thought to myself, goodness me, like, could you have not just memorized?
Yeah, if Goldberg can play the whole Bach preludes, you know, I think you can do two songs. Yeah, I know. I've sometimes been lazy and I've done exactly the same thing, I must confess. And I've had a file in front of me because life is busy. But when you learn a show off by heart, it's a completely different experience for the audience.
I think it was Charles Mingus who made all his musicians memorize their parts. And he said that you play something differently when you play it from memory than when you're reading it.
So what about your experience of doing that, Tim? I've seen you do both. What's it like for you doing that?
Yeah, I usually find if I've written something, it's actually quite easy to memorize it because the train of logic is present in my mind. So if I have to write a talk or if I have to write a song or something, it's easy for me to retrace the grooves that got me from the beginning to the end.
Right.
And I don't have to use kind of memory techniques and things like that. I do find it very, very fruitful. Yeah.
I think it's something to do also with the shared space between the performer and the audience. Mm-hmm. It's that, excuse me, sorry, when people are performing, when there's no words in the way, the space is between them. There's no barrier and you're in a shared space. So the bards, you know, from whom I take my inspiration, of course they would know everything off by heart. There was no other way to know it. It was passed down from person to person. You would take at least 12 years to become a bard, and you would need to know the epic poems and to be able to write your own. So think of the wealth, and we all know of other cultures on other continents where this is the case and they can memorize remarkable things. But also the joy of watching someone just sing or just speak is, it's almost like magic, isn't it? It's like a sacramental moment. In fact, Reverend Helen Orr and myself are going to be doing a talk tomorrow morning about creativity and the sacramental life. Yeah. And I think it bears on this question as well, that we're drawing from something profound and revealing our own interiority. And honestly, the excitement when you watch, do you remember watching BBC Musician of the Year? Maybe I don't know whether you watched that in South Africa, but maybe not. I was absolutely glued to it. And you'd watch this really young child, maybe 12 years old, go on stage with a cello, and they were about to play some enormous symphony. And it was like watching a miracle, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
I wanted to ask you about that poem that I wrote about the memories of that gorgeous happy holiday.
Mm-hmm.
I love that poem. And I was really interested by your question about why do we love the memory almost more than the experience? And John Paul II talks about nostalgia and love and simplicity. I think it's when we've written about something and somehow captured it, we've tasted its eternal value. And we've entered into an eternal space.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of something that C.S. Lewis said, which I thought was really wonderful, where he, in the Space Trilogy, there's this creature which is with an unpronounceable name.
He's not as good at names as his beloved friend Tolkien, is he?
Yeah, and who says that he's very surprised at he encounters a human being, you know, this man Ransom, who comes onto this planet and they're speaking about, you know, like different experiences that have a very high level of enjoyment. And he said he found it very strange that human beings would kind of want to just hone in on the experience itself, whereas for them they saw three parts to an event. I'm just doing this from memory, so bear with me. There is the anticipation of it.
Yeah.
There is when it actually happens, and then there is the memory of it, and they see that all as one thing.
How interesting. Ah, yes. This is in Perelandra when they're tasting the fruit, is it?
No, it wasn't. It was okay. It was in the first one, from the Silent Planet, I think it was.
Out of the Silent Planet.
Yeah. So
I don't remember this discussion, but it's very interesting.
And I think that there's something in that like to see the wholeness of a thing like that.
Well, who was it who said that every hour is sealed for eternity? And so that if you can...
I don't know. You've quoted it, didn't you?
I have. Somebody must have told me on a bus or something. I don't know. Anyway, maybe we should just give the word prompt again.
Yeah, so we are sadly out of time, and we wouldn't be able to continue. But needless to say, I think there's a lot to be reflected on with regards to memory, and it's something not to be neglected. And one thing I really wanted to draw out is that when the human mind hold something, it's not the same as when a machine holds it.
We are
like soil, and depending on how well.
I would so love to reflect on that for another half hour, Tim. And can I just say that Hans-Urs von Balthasar said that Mary is the memory of the church.
Oh, wow.
And that's worth reflecting on.
Yes, and we must also remember that Christ said to us, do this in memory of me. And if we have a very impoverished understanding of memory, then that's going to be a very tepid statement compared to what it really truly should mean.
Well, do you know that Mnemosyne, who is the goddess of memory in Greek legend, is the mother of the muses?
Okay.
So there's a few things to think about, Tim. I always love this show because I never know what we're going to talk about exactly. But just to say that the prompt was to find in your memory a moment when you had suddenly understood something about the faith differently or newly or perhaps for the first time, and just to write down that experience and capture it, and then to learn something off by heart and rejoice in telling it to somebody, just like the children of Walsingham do when they run out in the car park outside of Mass and go, Sarah, I'm going to do you a poem. Oh, I'm so excited. I'm going to be Bella's sponsor for confirmation. Such are the joys of being surrounded by children.
All right, so that's it for today's episode of the Bardcast B-Side. Do listen to the Bardcast episode 15 if you haven't already. There's still time to get your poems and your memorized pieces of poetry or other things in. And what we do here is take poems old and new to the cutting edge of culture because...
The cutting edge is grace. Pope St. John Paul II, pray for us.
Pray for us.
In eloianum veloishan loianum veloishan. A Psalm of David. Behold, he neither sleeps nor slumbers, the guardian of Israel.
You've been listening to one of Radio Maria's podcasts. If you enjoyed this, please consider supporting us with a once-off or monthly donation. To do so, visit www.radiomariaengland.uk or call 0300 302 1251 during office hours.